Basics of PPP. I've worked with PPP many times in my life, primarily in the PPP over Ethernet form in my job as a T1 and DSL ISP technician, but also in a few other contexts, including, of course, as a dial-up internet subscriber. More recently, however, I began looking into how dial-up internet connections work at a nuts and bolts level, with the idea in mind that I might set up some kind of small dial-up ISP for a hobby project. Prior to this, I had ignored PPP. I knew about it, but I thought of it as simply something that dial-up uses, among other things, somehow. But once I began working with the nitty-gritty of dial-up networking, I found that I had to learn how it worked at a low level. I was able to turn up a basic dial-up connection between Windows machines without knowing much, but it turns out this is not because PPP is simple, but because Windows uses the same default settings on its servers and its clients, which obscures this entire protocol from the admin. So when I began trying to connect non-Windows clients, I immediately began to run into confusing problems. For instance, my Macintosh Performa 630 would dial up, then perform no authentication and simply declare the session active, even though the server disagreed with this. It took me most of a day to figure out why this was happening, and I didn't get an inch closer to an answer until I simply buckled down and began reading the raw protocol specifications. Of course, I Googled PPP, I read about it on Wikipedia, but I found the dry, contextless summary there unsatisfying. I didn't really understand what role it played in networking, how it interacted with Ethernet or IP, what the host was doing to provide the service, and why there were so many settings. As I would discover later, there's also two fundamentally different ways of turning up PPP sessions that the wiki page doesn't mention at all. I couldn't see a straightforward way to edit the wiki article to add the information I learned, so I figured making my own page might be a better choice. This is mostly for the sake of entertainment, since dial-up networking is largely dead, though as far as I know this information is applicable to PPPoE as well, so you might find some of it useful if you work at an ISP. If you want a fully technical understanding of PPP, I imagine you can't do much better than the O'Reilly book, which you can borrow from Internet Archive. The article you're reading here, however, is written to help the already capable network technician understand the role that PPP plays. I hope you find it interesting or useful. PPP was born out of a need to organize data being sent over serial links. This is connected to some fundamental limitations of serial and to the OSI layer model that you might have learned about before, but probably barely understood given the quality of most teaching. So going over both of these will be helpful. In other articles, I've explained that serial or RS-232 connections are simple byte pipes over which the basic transfer unit is 1 byte. To state it clearly, every transaction over a serial port is always exactly 1 byte. If you have two computers connected via a serial link, you have to send 1 byte, 8 bits, over the link before the receiving machine will do anything with them. Its serial controller waits for 8 bits to come across before it tells the receiving computer that any data has come in. If you were to somehow send less, you would either get no response or a corrupted, meaningless output at the far end. 4 bits, for instance, is meaningless in the language of serial because in both the sending and receiving machines, the hardware and software components that process serial signaling only speak in whole bytes and are simply incapable of being given less or more data. And that latter part there is crucial. There's no way to make a single transaction over serial that is larger than 1 byte within the constraints of RS-232 itself. Suppose that you're sending a 60-character message over a serial port. There's no built-in ceremony in the serial port signaling to give any details about your message. You don't have a way to tell the receiving computer, okay, a message is starting, and you don't have a way to tell it, alright, that was the whole message. If the receiving computer wants to accumulate your entire message before displaying it to the user, how does it know when all of it has arrived? It needs a way to know where the beginning and the end are. This problem is endemic to all networking, in fact, nearly all computer communication. Connections between computers, or even between devices inside a computer, like your PCI cards, are simply electrical signals toggling on and off, and in order for it to make any sense, the two ends of the conversation need a previously agreed upon way to interpret those signals. This is usually called framing when it happens at an electrical level, and a protocol when it happens at higher layers of abstraction. Sometimes you'll see these terms used interchangeably, though. In Ethernet, for instance, the way that bits are actually sent down the wire as on and off voltage pulses is called physical layer framing. It's how the receiving computer knows which pulses represent a byte, and it's also how it knows where one Ethernet message ends and another one begins. There are special patterns that let the network interface card understand that the sending computer is beginning or ending a transaction, so the receiving machine can bundle up all the bytes that represent that transaction. That's known as an Ethernet frame. Once one frame is received, the computer still only has a pile of bytes. It knows how many bytes were part of the frame, but it doesn't know what any of them mean. This is where the Ethernet data link protocol takes over. It knows that certain bytes tell it who the frame came from, other bytes tell it who the frame is intended to reach, and finally, it knows what's in the frame. If you ever learned about the OSI model, you might recognize these as layers 1 and 2. Now, not much is exactly designed to fit the OSI model, but it is a useful way to think about this subject, and it maps nicely to what we're talking about. In serial communications, RS-232 is the layer 1 protocol. It specifies a way to make electrical impulses out of bytes and vice versa. In early computing, RS-232 was not really used as a networking protocol. It was simply a way of connecting computers directly to each other, at which point the protocol, if you will, was usually a human typing on a keyboard. The program executed on the far end was designed with this in mind, and it had its own ways of interpreting what the user was typing, so there was really no framing beyond throwing bytes back and forth. There were automated systems that communicated over serial, but all of them were designed with the expectation that they knew exactly what they were talking to. If you have a motion sensor connected to a central alarm system over RS-232, it has its own dedicated port, which the central system knows goes to, say, sensor number 3, and both the sensor and the system know exactly how to talk to each other at all times. One will only send messages that the other is designed to understand. When people began building computer networks, they didn't use RS-232 for the core connectivity. They built new media, like Ethernet. And when they began building larger networks like the internet, they designed new protocols, particularly internet protocol. These both made large networks viable, because every packet sent from one computer to another had lots of information about who it came from, where it was going, and what was inside of it. If you were at a university with a direct Ethernet connection, connecting to the internet when it came along was trivial. For basically everyone who wasn't at a university or a business with Ethernet, however, connecting to these new networks, the internet and others using its technology, required a modem. Networks connected to each other over a long distance or in an ad hoc fashion would also have been forced to use dial-up links over modems. This was a problem because, as I discussed in my other article, modems simply turn a phone call into a very long serial cable and provide no function beyond that. A serial connection is not a great way to send packets back and forth. You can't send Ethernet over it directly because it simply doesn't have the properties of Ethernet, electrically or logically. It doesn't even have framing beyond single bytes. You need a protocol that will turn this byte pipe into something that sends whole transactions. The earliest standard solution to this, although it literally called itself a non-standard, was called SLIP, which was published in 1988 and took the place of Ethernet in the network stack. It was whipped up in a hot hurry to solve the problem in the quickest, dirtiest way possible, and it really did solve it in the quickest, dirtiest way possible. SLIP provided framing to serial connections, but it was just enough that a computer could hurl raw IP packets down a serial connection, and the receiving machine would know where each one ended. Almost everything else had to be handled in other ways. There was no ability to negotiate how a connection would work. The calling machine needed to know what IP address it was supposed to have, for instance. There was also no authentication built in, which is a topic we'll discuss later. In researching all this, I had to read the SLIP RFC, and if you're remotely technical, you should too, because it's a hoot. The author as much says, "Don't use this, something better is coming soon." It's hard to even call it a protocol. It is, and I'm not joking here, absolutely nothing more than IP packets shot down a serial line, raw, with a 2-byte sequence called end at the end of each one. Every time the receiving machine sees an end sequence, it just wraps up everything it received since the last end, says, "Yep, that's a packet," and hands it off to the OSIP layer. There's literally nothing else in the protocol definition, except to say that if the magic end sequence happens to occur inside of an actual packet, it has to be preceded by an escape byte. This is such a bare-bones protocol that it actually has no way to handle line noise. In virtually every network protocol that exists, there is some kind of checksum field to confirm that data wasn't damaged during transit. SLIP doesn't have this, but the RFC says that someone suggested just sending an end at the beginning of every packet, too. That way, if any spurious line noise had produced erroneous data since the last packet had been sent, the receiving machine would wrap that up into a packet, hand it to the IP layer, which would promptly throw it away since it was impossible to parse as IP, and move on with a clean slate. So slip was extremely limited and didn't last long. By 1990, the PPP standard was published, and it provided much more sophisticated solutions to all these problems. So in summary, PPP is a layer 2 protocol that replaces Ethernet in the network stack so that IP packets can be sent over plain serial connections, usually over a modem link. It's actually a pretty nice one, all things considered. The first feature of PPP is that it provides framing on the serial link. It has well-defined byte sequences that mark the beginning and end of a packet, and then a number of fields that describe its contents. This framing is not actually unique. In fact, it's almost identical to another existing standard called HDLC. HDLC isn't specifically an IP transport. It was just an already known method to packetize data on a serial connection. It could have been used just like SLIP was, to just cram IP packets into the serial pipe and let the other machine unbundle and transmit them onto the destination network. But there were other features users and networks needed, requirements that were unique to dial-up service. Here are some of the things they needed. First, a way to know if packets were being corrupted in transit. This is actually solved by the HDLC framing itself because it adds a checksum field, much like Ethernet has, so a PPP recipient can throw away a corrupted packet without having to burden the IP layer with detecting that corruption. Also, a way to assign IP addresses to connecting users. Now, you might think, why not just send a DHCP packet over the link once it's established? The answer is because PPP hosts aren't using Ethernet, and thus they don't have MAC addresses. The PPP server would have to either transmit the request from its own MAC address, which doesn't make any sense to DHCP, or make up a phony MAC, which violates a dozen standards. A method is needed for PPP itself to assign an IP to a user. It might also be the case that some networks weren't using Ethernet, didn't have DHCP, and thus had no built-in method for handling DHCP anyway. I don't know anything about that myself, but it seems like a possibility at the time. Also, authentication. SLIP would have either given a connecting user access to the IP network with zero authentication the moment their modem handshake completed, or it may have been used in an inconvenient interactive logon scenario, which I'll explain later. Neither of these are desirable for a robust internet access protocol, which should have its own way to authenticate users before they're able to contact the host system. Also, extensibility. Users began to want the ability to implement encryption and compression, among other things, often in ways that had not yet been invented, but were sure to be in time. And finally, support for other protocols. In past decades, protocols other than IP were far more common. If PPP, like SLIP, treated absolutely everything fired down the pipe as an IP packet, it would have no way to send non-IP packets, like AppleTalk, for instance. This is less relevant nowadays, but even now, the PPP client also needs a way to communicate with the host and negotiate things about the PPP session itself. And this requires the ability to mark a packet somehow as a maintenance protocol so the PPP server knows to pay attention to it. PPP solves all of this by providing a suite of sub-protocols, if you will. Initially, there was just LCP and NCP, which are used to set up the initial connection. Later standards provided IPCP, CCP, MP, PAP, CHAP, and many other things to fill in all these functional gaps. So here's the basic PPP process, which is probably what you were looking for when you came here. So what actually happens when you dial up and establish a PPP session? Well, there's actually a couple versions of how things can go down. There's, of course, tons and tons of variations, but there's two major types. Here's how a very modern exchange using a Windows XP client and a Server 2003 host looks. First, your PC tells your modem to dial your ISP. Your ISP's modem receives a ring message and answers. The two modems handshake, and now there's a serial connection between your system and theirs. On your PC, the PPP client sends the initiating PPP packet, an LCP configuration request, which tells the host what features it has. There's a ton of stuff that could be included at this stage, but on a modern system, you'll probably see it ask for link compression in particular. An interesting feature implemented at this stage as well, which is largely relevant nowadays, is callback. Your system could actually give the far end its own phone number, then hang up and wait for the server to call it back to proceed with negotiation. This saved on telephone charges since inbound calls were not billed per minute to the end user, and the ISP got a much better per minute rate. Next, the host sends back an LCP configuration request saying what features it has. Client hosts can now send LCP configuration reject if they don't like something that the other wants, and this can proceed till both sides agree on a set of features. Now the client sends an LCP identification packet with its host name, among other things. This is actually a much later feature. It was only added in 1994. It's not used for authentication. It just helps the host know who it's talking to, so it can make decisions even before authentication is possible. Now the client authenticates. There's many protocols for doing this. There's PAP, in which the client simply sends a single packet containing a username and password, and the host either accepts or rejects it. There's CHAP, which provides some level of security by hashing the password. There's EAP, which extends authentication to support all kinds of wacky schemes, some of them perhaps even a little secure. There's MSChap and MSChap V2, which are Microsoft's variants of CHAP, and probably countless other options. If authentication succeeds, the client and server now exchange more CCP packets to negotiate data compression. This is very important because it can more than double the effective speed of a connection. Now the client sends an IPCP configuration request in order to ask for an IP address. This is similar to DHCP in that the client can ask for a specific address which the server may allow or deny. If the client sends 0 in the request, the server will pick an address of its own choosing. Now the server responds with an IPCP configuration ACK, which gives the client an IP address and DNS server addresses, and the connection is now established. IP packets begin flowing, and when they arrive at the host end, they're forwarded onto the IP network. There could also be steps in here that would establish encryption if it were enabled, but I don't know exactly how those look. This is a pretty slick process. It's quick, it's flexible, it has lots of room for expansion. It's a well-designed protocol, at least in my eyes, and one which adds very little overhead. It's about 8 bytes per packet on a good day, which isn't nothing on a serial connection, but it could be a lot worse. Now, there's a totally different way of setting up PPP, which is worth discussing, because it influenced the design of all PPP software, and that's the Unix approach. Now, you'll need some context for this, which fortunately is half the fun. People had been dialing into university, business, and network service provider systems for decades by the time the internet was created. Shared Unix systems, in particular, were commonly available throughout the 80s, and when the internet came along, they were the first machines to be connected to it. You should keep in mind that at this time, so let's say 1990, home computers were still pathetic in comparison to virtually any Unix machine. In addition to simply having a more sophisticated OS than any PC was running, you could expect Unix machines to have much, much more speed and storage, as well as already having access to things like Usenet and email. At that time, it was not typically the case that you would have, say, an email client on your home computer. Instead, you would dial into a Unix machine owned by your employer, school, or another provider with access to the nascent wide area networks of the 80s. You would then log into a shell account and then run your email client on the remote machine. The shell account gave the connected user access to a Unix shell, much like the /bin/sh that we still have on Linux, from which they could do anything they liked on the remote machine, but only interactively, as if they were sitting at a keyboard connected to the Unix machine itself. Your home computer could not join the larger network as a peer. Once dialed into a shell, it was nothing more than a terminal attached to a computer that was a fully fledged member of the growing networked world. With the introduction of IP, it started to become sensible that your machine at home could be a member of the internet in its own right. IP enabled network operators to assign addresses to users joined over ad hoc connections and route them through arbitrarily complex networks. The most obvious way to do this was to upgrade the existing Unix systems to offer that service to dialed-in users, and that's what SLIP and later PPP enabled. Using the exact same methods, a modem connected to a serial port, the Unix systems could now offer internet connectivity. The problem was, what if you didn't want that? Even after internet access was available, not everything was on the internet, and people didn't instantly move all their tasks to their home computer. Many never did. In fact, many still haven't. You might know someone who has a perfectly functional Windows, Mac, or Linux computer in front of them, but does almost everything through an SSH session to some server. They have their reasons, and people did in 1989 as well. Unix systems couldn't stop serving up shell accounts, which presents a problem, because if you dial into a system like that, how does it know whether you want a PPP session or a shell session? With a Windows server or a dedicated ISP server, it's no problem. As soon as a user connects, you just blast a PPP LCP packet at them and wait for their response. But with a Unix system, in the late 80s, you actually had to assume that most users don't want internet access, but still offer a way to get it if they want it. The solution was to implement PPP as a program a user could run when they wanted internet access. A user with a normal shell account could dial up, connect, check their email and newsgroup updates, and then, if they wanted, type PPP. This would launch a PPP server process on the Unix machine, which would immediately spit out a very distinctive opening salvo of right braces, pound signs, slashes, and so on. The PPP client software running on their machine would recognize this, take over the serial connection, and complete the PPP exchange and initiate an internet connection. The consequence of this is that all PPP clients had to, and still have to, support this capability. The PPP client for classic macOS, for instance, MacPPP, supports an option to display a terminal window in which you can manually tell the modem to dial, wait for the Unix login prompt, type your username and password, then type PPP, and once you see that distinctive string of gibberish, click OK to tell the PPP client to start the negotiation process. I'm not sure if this was actually used by many people or was more of a diagnostic tool. You couldn't easily automate the login process to a Unix system because it was, after all, simply bytes being thrown at your machine. If you took the naive approach, your PPP client could just wait for the modem handshake, then fire your username and password down the line, followed by the PPP command. The problem is, you'd never get the timing right if you did this, because login prompts usually had extra text in them, like "Welcome to the Berkeley South Campus Unix User System," "Warning, this system is for use by students and faculty," and so on. If you tried to automate this naively, your machine would probably punch in your username about when the remote system was halfway through the word "welcome," or it would send the PPP command while the system was busy authenticating your password, and it would just be absorbed and ignored. The solution to this was something called a chat script. If you've ever used the Linux utility Expect, this works just the same. This is a script that you configure with the exact messages the server is expected to output. It's how you tell your PPP client what to wait for to know when it's safe to send your username, password, and whatever other commands are needed to start the connection. From MacPPP, for instance, I have a screenshot that shows, on the first line, a box that says "wait" in front of it, and then "annex username." The next line says "out," and it says "Carlson." The next line says "wait, annex password." The next line says "out," and it has a blanked out password in this screenshot. The next line then waits for the word "annex" and a colon, and then the last line sends PPP. The wait lines, as you may have gathered, means "wait for this text," and the outline means "send this to the server." You'll notice a very important detail here. The username and password fields on this Unix machine don't simply say "username," they say "annex username," presumably the name of the server. Some systems also simply use the string "username" with a capital U, which the chat script needed to account for because it was case sensitive. As far as I can tell, nobody was ever completely comfortable with this, even if they knew which capitalization their server used, because every chat script I've seen only checks for the partial string "surname" and the string "assword," which makes this all worth it. The shell prompt here is also not a pound sign like it is on many Unix systems. Maybe this system wasn't Unix. I grabbed this from the University of Utah Math Department website, so who knows what they ran. Or perhaps it was simply using an unusual shell. The point is, you'd need to customize this to your specific dial-up internet server, and if that server ever changed behavior, your script would stop working, and you wouldn't know why. It would just sit there and wait and do nothing, and all you'd be able to do is log into the machine manually to figure out what changed. It was a wild time. Now, as a footnote to this topic, we should talk about SLIRP. S-L-I-R-P, because that's actually somewhat still relevant. PPP as an open protocol was, of course, implemented in a lot of different ways. Unix had PPP, Solaris had something called APPPLS, and I'm sure other Unix variants had their own implementations. All these were operating system features and operated hand-in-hand with the OS itself. This meant you needed to have permission to use them. Suppose you didn't have permission to run PPP. You had access to a shell account on a Unix machine connected to the internet, you could run your own IP-capable programs on it, but you weren't allowed to initiate PPP, connect your home computer, and download porn with Mosaic 1.0. This was frequently the case, probably because system access sold as a shell account would have cost much less in terms of bandwidth than directly connecting a home computer. These would have been separate tiers of service, and some system operators wouldn't have wanted to provide direct internet access, period. Well, the enterprise and computer nerd has no time for restrictions of that sort, even if they cost someone else a lot of money, and so along came SLIRP. SLIRP was written by some Australian guy around 1995 or so, distributed for free, so probably much more popular than the commercial program TIA, which did much the same thing a little earlier, and it simply cheats the system. You would download this program, compile it within your Unix shell account, and execute it just like the PPP command. It would then negotiate PPP, or SLIP if you wanted that for some reason, exactly the same as the native PPP server, and voila, you're on the internet. The difference is that unlike the PPP server, which interacts with the OSIP stack to obtain a dedicated IP and therefore make your home computer a first-class citizen, Slurp actually implemented an early form of NAT. Since programs running under your shell account had the right to make their own IP connections, Slurp proxied all the packets from your home system through its own process so it could operate without the OS's assistance or permission. Slurp is interesting because you can still use it without much configuration today. I experimented with it to get a Mac online using a Raspberry Pi and a plain serial connection, and it worked, well, it worked okay. It wasn't great, for reasons I'll detail at a later date in an article I'm still working on, but it did work, and all I had to do was install one program, not create a bunch of configs and a virtual network interface and who knows what else. You might also find it useful to make two old computers talk to each other. Setting up PPP on an HP UX system is probably a pain, but if you can get the Slurp code on there, you can get an IP connection to anything you want to plug into the serial port. So, in conclusion, I'm very new to this. I may have gotten some things wrong, especially the historical context, which is very hard to find out from scratch at this point. So if you have firsthand experience and have a factual disagreement with any of this, please let me know. I was barely conscious when most of this technology went out of style. With that said, not to totally excuse myself from responsibility, this topic mostly just doesn't matter anymore. So I wrote this more for entertainment than for instruction. It's accurate to the best of my knowledge, but I've speculated and I've cut corners in a few places, and I've not yet even finished the O'Reilly PPP book. I find it easier to write as I learn, however, because you're never done learning. If this was interesting to you, or if you did something interesting with it, email me, articles@gekk.info. If you like my work, consider tossing me a few bucks at my Ko-fi, ko-fi.com/gravis. It takes a lot of effort, and payment helps me stay motivated. Thank you.